Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a special Monday edition of the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And I want to start off the podcast by saying I am very proud of the missus, my better half, the one and only Laura Horn. Last night, she put together, well, she's been actually planning this for quite a while, a pro-life training session for us to run out of our own home. And so she put the whole thing together, got the curriculum from our old partners, Justice for All. You've heard me talk about Justice for All a lot here on the podcast and on Catholic Answers Live. It's where Laura and I got our chops in, our skills in dialogue, how to speak with people who disagree with us on contentious issues, especially the issue of abortion. Both of us, I spent several years and Laura spent a whole summer interning with Justice for All, learning how to talk about the issue of abortion and going on campus and dialoguing with people who disagree with us on that subject. And Laura felt compelled that she wants to do more. And I think a lot of people listening can resonate with how my wife is feeling, that sometimes you get stuck in the daily grind of life. You know, you go to work, or if you're, especially if you're a stay-at-home mom like my wife, you're at home, you're with the kids, you do play dates, you have this desire, you want to do more. What can I do out there to evangelize? What can I do out there to be pro-life, to do good for the kingdom? Now, one thing I think is important is just to be able, Laura and I talked about this morning before I went to work. Sometimes you're called to be a teacher. You're called to equip and influence others who will go out and do amazing things because of what you've done. You know, they say behind every great man is a great woman. They talk about, you know, male leaders, things like that. There are wives who support them. But I'm thinking more of, especially for parents, especially if you're a mom, you're at home raising children, you should take pride in that you are the person who will form them for the rest of their life. And that, I believe, is an ideal for parents to be intimately involved in the formation and education of their children and not to farm that out unnecessarily to other people. There is a quote, basically it goes like this from G.K. Chesterton. He said, if something is worth doing, it's worth doing badly. And what he meant by that was he was talking about the epidemic in his time of people who believed that only experts should raise children. So you should have nannies and daycares or others raising children, and you shouldn't do that because you don't really know what you're doing. And Chesterton talked about how irreplaceable and unique parents are in the lives of children. He said, look, even if you're not some expert, like these quote-unquote experts at raising children, you are still this child's mother or father, and God placed them in your life for a special reason. So even if you're not an expert, even if you don't know what you're doing, something is worth doing, even if it's done badly. You know, so we should still get out there and give it our try. And so we did this training session at our home. Oh, well, to finish my thought on that, that my wife and I were talking that if you feel stifled, what do I do? There are still people in your life that you can encourage, you can teach, your children, relatives, friends. And for me, you know, I the reason that I'm pro-life is because a few older individuals took the time to mentor me to help bring me to the point where I am. My wife said the reason that she's pro-life is because her mother and father invested so much in her seeing how important this is. Even if they're not out on the front lines, you know, debating this issue on a college campus or something, they taught her, and now she goes and does this. She goes and teaches other people. It reminds me of what St. Paul writes in his letter to Timothy. I think it's 1 Timothy 2:2. St. Paul says to Timothy, to take what you have received from me in the presence of many faithful witnesses and pass it on to others who can teach others. Is it 2 Timothy 2:2? Yeah, it's 2 Timothy 2:2. So it's all the twos in there. Let me bring that up here, make sure that I am reciting it carefully. 2 Timothy 2:2. Well, 2 Timothy chapter 2, St. Paul says, you then, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus, and what you have heard from me before many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. I love the next line too, verse 3. Take your share of suffering as a good soldier of Christ Jesus. You know, going out into the world to proclaim the gospel. And part of that is taking what we have heard from others, those who have taught us, and teaching others who will be able to teach others also. That's what I love in 2 Timothy 2:2. Well, you've heard from me before many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. We call that the multiplier effect. That when you do something, you should always seek to try to multiply your efforts to not just to teach and equip others, but get them to the level where they're going to do that for other people. Because myself, you know, that's why I love creating resources like Why We're Catholic. I love creating curricula because there's only a very small finite number of people that I can teach and train in my lifetime, you know, that I could go to a parish and speak, or people will watch my videos. Even if I use YouTube, there's still a small number. But those people who encounter my work, that if they take this and then go and teach others and they teach others, you've got an exponential effect right here. That is why a church that began with 12 guys, most of them former fishermen, a former tax collector, trying to figure out what they're supposed to be doing. You start with 12 people 2,000 years ago. Now, there are 2 billion Christians in the world. You have to have that exponential growth, that multiplier effect, by teaching others, not just so that they learn, but so that they are equipped to be able to teach others as well. That's what I do with all these resources, what I do with the podcast. And that's what I love, that you can learn from this podcast and then share it with others and equip them to go out and explain and defend our Catholic faith. So if you want to help the podcast continue, definitely check out, of course, trendhornpodcast.com. If you're not a monthly subscriber, I would highly encourage you to do that. You get access to bonus content that I'm uploading. I've got some special bonus content that'll be up by the end of the week here, still in its mystery wrapping paper. I'll talk about that more tomorrow. But also for $10 a month, you get a fancy t-shirt with my mug on it. And of course, it keeps the podcast going. And when you're a subscriber, when you make a monthly gift, you are invited to submit questions that will be answered right here on the podcast. And those who are gold level subscribers, I think, have been really appreciative. Any kind of random question they have for the podcast on apologetics, evangelization, theology, I am happy to answer here, and I'm happy for their support. So definitely consider that. Check out trendhornpodcast.com to help keep us going. So what I wanted to talk about today is that I'm proud that my wife did this pro-life training, and there were a lot of people, it was our friends who came over, and they just were really upset about everything they hear about abortion in the news, and they want to know how to talk about it, but without getting completely flustered. So I thought what would be fun to talk about today on the show is what is going on in our country related to abortion, especially late-term abortion, because it seems like the people who are committed to keeping abortion legal are just trying to run for the end zone to get a ridiculous Hail Mary pass and touchdown. They want to just go for the fences with their support for legal abortion, saying that abortion, the model they want is very similar to what's in Canada, which is the most liberal or extreme abortion law that could exist is simply not having any laws about abortion at all. That's what happened in New York. Abortion was simply removed from the state penal code. And we talked about that a week or two ago here on the podcast. Definitely check out that past episode. I think it was actually last Monday when I talked about the New York late-term abortion law. And I gave some tips in here for addressing misconceptions that people have about late-term abortion and how to dialogue about it. But I realized there were still things I hadn't even touched on in that podcast. And it's important to talk about this because we're seeing now other states are adopting these radical proposals to either make abortion legal through all 9 months of pregnancy for virtually any reason, or to just remove abortion entirely from the penal code so that it's not a criminal matter. I mean, you have to regulate how abortions are done, I guess, in quotes, because usually those regulations just exist to try to keep pro-life advocates from peacefully evangelizing and praying in front of abortion facilities. They're hardly ever in states where the administration, where the government is very supportive of legal abortion. Those regulations are frankly hardly enforced against abortion providers. You have to drag people by tooth and nail to get them to do anything because they want to keep abortion legal no matter the cost, even if it means turning a blind eye to these nefarious, who are already nefarious for ending the lives of unborn children, these individuals who don't care if they hurt women, people like Kermit Gosnell. Go back and listen to my podcast episode about the Gosnell movie, and that, you know, is turning a blind eye. It's like, well, at least he's doing the anti-Lord's work of abortion, is kind of what I think these people think when it comes to these late-term abortion providers, because there's not many people who go out and do this. There's really only a handful of abortion providers in the country who are willing to do late-term abortions in the third trimester of pregnancy, because this is the gruesomest stuff that you can come across. And even people who are you know, they're dead into this idea of, you know, of protecting human life, they just don't have the stomach to go all the way to the third trimester when you have a viable child who's capable of feeling pain. Many, even abortion providers, aren't willing to go that far, but a handful are. You've got Dr. Warren Hearn in Boulder, Colorado. You've got Curtis Boyd in New Mexico. In fact, that brings me to a article that this is coming to New Mexico, that Curtis Boyd has been doing abortions, late-term abortions in New Mexico, up to 32 weeks now for a long time. I remember living in New Mexico and praying at, I think it was like Southwestern Women's Center, where he does this. And there's courageous pro-lifers there because it's a very pro-choice, very liberal state. And so it's very hard to try to get any traction. So this is an article that was published last Wednesday in the Albuquerque Journal. It says, the State House in New Mexico pushed ahead late Wednesday with a bill that would repeal New Mexico's anti-abortion law, one of just eight of its kind left in the country. The proposal passed 40-29, now heads to the Senate for consideration. The legislation aims to remove a state law that makes it a crime to end a woman's pregnancy, except in certain circumstances, such as rape. Now, in a lot of these cases, you have states where abortion used to be illegal and the law is on the books, but simply not enforced. So now there's a concern that since the Supreme Court has changed its makeup, that Roe versus Wade is in danger, Roe versus Wade will be overturned. And if there's this antiquated law you don't enforce that makes abortion illegal, some people call it a trigger law. It's just going to go into effect once Roe versus Wade is overturned. And so people are rushing, in New York as an example, and other states, of passing their own state protections on abortion. Because remember what I said in the previous episode on abortion, Roe versus Wade does not make abortion legal in all 50 states. It just keeps states from outlawing it. So if you get rid of Roe, as a state, you can choose to make abortion legal or illegal, depending on what you and the state, what you want. So some of these states are rushing now that they want to go for the fences and say, well, no, we want abortion, and we want it all 9 months of pregnancy. We're taking it off the penal code. We're pro-woman. I think with the election coming up here in 2020, a lot of people who support abortion, who identify as being liberal, they want to show their mark, show their color. So they want to take a really extreme view. I think they saw in 2016, hey, here's a guy who just took extreme views, and now he's president. Well, I'm going to take extreme views. And so they're doing it with abortion and saying, I'm not going to apologize. And they're just, instead of being moderate and reasonable, they want to seem as if they are just driven and hardened and they don't let anyone boss them around. So they pass these absurd laws that eventually lead to infanticide, as we saw with Governor Northam in Virginia saying on radio that if a baby was going to be aborted and it's born alive, you just kind of let the baby die. And now Congress, I think, was looking into passing a bill that would have guaranteed legal protection for children who survive abortions. And I think it did not. It was supposed to get a unanimous vote, but I think one Democratic senator voted against it. And, you know, that's the world we live in. So to go on with the with what's happening in Albuquerque, Representative Joanne Ferrari, a Las Cruces Democrat and co-sponsor of the bill, says it simply removes an antiquated law that criminalizes health care. Opponents, in turn, said the measure would go too far, that it would weaken safeguards that ensure medical providers can avoid participating in an abortion as a matter of conscience. They also assailed New Mexico as the late-term abortion capital of the country and said more restrictions, not fewer, are needed. Ferrari and other supporters argued repeatedly that no one would be forced to perform abortions. State and federal laws already ensure medical providers can abstain from procedures they object to, except in emergencies, she said. But therein lies the problem, because people, when you hear people defend late-term abortion, what they'll say is, well, nobody just flippantly goes and gets a late-term abortion. No one just wakes up and says, I'm going to get a late-term abortion. That it's always these dire medical circumstances where, you know, a woman's life is in danger, for example. And so we need it in these cases. So if they argue that if the definition of health in these cases is so broad, that it's anything, as Doe versus Bolton Roe v. Wade's companion case puts it, if health involves physical, emotional, psychological, familial, age-related, and it's an urgent matter, you're about to give birth and you don't want your health impacted, I could see emergency being defined very weakly here to coerce doctors to be involved in this, because there's very few abortion providers who are willing to do these late-term procedures. And the ones who do it, they are always getting into trouble for something. In New Mexico, Curtis Boyd is actually, a judge has allowed a lawsuit to go through against him. It's for an interesting reason that Boyd did a late-term abortion and he took the remains of the child and took it to be used as tissue research at the University of New Mexico, which teaches people how to do abortions, by the way, where he's an adjunct professor. And so what it says here is that the woman is suing him because the form that he gave her was misleading. This is also a little side note here to show that grammar matters, people. One missing comma is why Curtis Boyd is now in trouble and a lawsuit is proceeding against him. Because the woman who signed the consent form to get her abortion, the relevant part says, tissue and parts will be removed during the procedure, comma. And I consent to their examination and their use in medical research and their disposal by the clinic and or physician. Now, that makes you seem like she allows the clinic or Boyd to do research on this. What Boyd meant to write was, I consent to their examination and their use in medical research, comma, and their disposal by the clinic and or physician. That's what he meant. That's called the Oxford comma. So, one, you know, sometimes it reminds you of Al Capone. You know, it's like they couldn't get Al Capone for all his gangster activities, but they finally got him for tax evasion. Now, Curtis Boyd finally goes to court, not for ending the lives of babies, but because he forgets a comma and goes against a consent form. You know, so sometimes you have to get people on the most minor technical of details. In fact, that's why Kermit Gosnell in Pennsylvania, Gosnell's abortion house of horrors there, the reason he was arrested was not related to abortion at first. It was violation of drug laws, violation of prescribing drugs without a proper prescription, violating drug protocols. That's what eventually brought him and his entire procedure down. So that's what's happening here. So what can we say, though, when there are myths that will come up related to the issue of late-term abortion? How do we talk about this? First, I think it's important for us to empathize with those who are going through a procedure like this. It's okay to be outraged. We should be outraged that this is happening. But at the same time, we want people to see that we are level-headed, that we are reasonable people. As I said in the training last night to our friends who stopped by, people won't think that your position is reasonable if you are not reasonable. My friend Steve Wagner put it this way. People won't think that the unborn are human until they think you're human. So if you seem very callous and uncaring, emotional, almost to the point of being frantic, people will have less confidence in the position you hold. But so we can say, yes, many people who go to have late-term abortion procedures oftentimes go because there is some kind of a diagnosis for their health, where a doctor says their health is in danger, or maybe their life is in danger, or usually there's a severe diagnosis for their unborn child. Their unborn child has some kind of fatal or severe medical condition that will impact their life. And so they're concerned about this, and they believe that, as I'll read you an article here in a second, death would be better than life in this case. And that is true in some cases, and we should have compassion for women who are faced with these very difficult choices. We should have compassion, but that compassion should not blind us to the moral logic that's involved. It also shouldn't make us think that every single late-term abortion, either late second trimester or third trimester, is done for a health-related reason. It isn't. There are cases where sometimes people don't know they're pregnant until the late second or early third trimester. Sometimes they are ambivalent. They're not sure if they want to go ahead with the procedure or not, and they're wrestling with it. They might have a dramatic change of life circumstances midway through their pregnancy and feel like they can't have a baby anymore. You know, loss of a job, abandonment by a spouse, a personal illness in the family of some kind. To read here, and to prove this, I have a citation in my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, from Martin Haskell. Martin Haskell, he was the guy who invented the partial birth abortion procedure, where the baby is delivered up to the head, the spinal cord is cut, and the baby is taken out of the body, which thankfully is now, the Supreme Court says, you can outlaw that procedure. It's barbaric. Interesting that comes up with this. Sometimes when I've been reading these articles about late-term abortion, you will find people who will say pro-life advocates make this stuff up. I read one that said, there's no such thing as late-term abortion. We just do abortions in the later term of pregnancy. Well, tomato, tomato, buddy. I mean, that's the best you can come up with. That's even worse than people who used to say, I've read this time and time again. I've read people who said there is no such thing as partial birth abortion. That when this was being debated, you had doctors saying, you had pro-choice advocates saying, there is no such thing as partial birth abortion. Doctors don't use terms like that. We've never heard of that procedure. Instead, it's called intact dilation and extraction. Well, that's like saying, if I'm a doctor, there's no such thing as heart attacks. There's no such thing as heart attacks. Does a doctor ever write down patient had a heart attack? No. We say he had a myocardial infarction. But okay, that's the technical term, but heart attack is a fine euphemism or a fine colloquial term to describe what happens to somebody when they have a myocardial infarction. And partial birth abortion is a completely fair description of what happens in an intact dilation. Baby is intact, cervix is dilated, baby is extracted, and then their life is ended. So keep that in mind when people try to use euphemisms on you and things like that. So Haskell invented partial birth abortion. This is what he says. I'll be quite frank. This was testimony before Congress, by the way. I have the citation in Persuasive Pro-Life. But he says, I'll be quite frank. Most of my abortions are elective in the 20 to 24 week range. And in my particular case, probably 20% are for genetic reasons. And the other 80% are purely elective. Okay, so it's not that every single one is some kind of a health case or a fetal abnormality. Sometimes it is so. So how do we respond to that? First, if someone says third trimester abortion is necessary to save a woman's life, that is absolutely not true. It can't be true. And the reason for that is when you look at the protocols for third trimester abortion, read Warren Hearn's book, Abortion Practice. You have to, I will play with you now a procedure. This is Dr. Anthony Lovatno. He used to do abortion procedures. And so he's describing what he's now pro-life, but he describes what happens in a third trimester abortion procedure.
They describe a third trimester induced abortion, which is performed at 25 weeks to term. At this point, the baby is almost fully developed and viable, meaning he or she could survive outside the womb if the mother were to go into labor prematurely. Because the baby is so large and developed, this procedure takes 3 or 4 days to complete.
There it is right there. It takes 3 or 4 days. I want to play it through more so you can explain to people what happens in these procedures. But if it takes 3 or 4 days and you have an emergency, this is not the way to go. And the third trimester, if you have an emergency and a woman's life is in danger, you would just do an emergency C-section. That's the fastest way to get the baby out, and you don't have to end the baby's life in doing that late in pregnancy. You wouldn't do a third trimester abortion because essentially it's the same thing as a vaginal birth, but the baby's life is ended before the birth. And here, the Lovatno explains how that happens.
Day one, the abortionist uses a large needle to inject a drug called digoxin. Digoxin is generally used to treat heart problems, but a high enough dosage of digoxin will cause fatal cardiac arrest. The abortionist inserts the needle with the digoxin through the woman's abdomen or through her vagina and into the baby, targeting either the head, torso, or heart. The baby will feel it. Babies at this stage feel pain. When the needle pierces the baby's body and the digoxin takes effect, the life of the baby will end. The abortionist then inserts multiple sticks of seaweed called laminaria into the woman's cervix. They will slowly open up the cervix for delivery of a stillborn baby. While the woman waits for the laminaria to dilate her cervix, she carries her dead baby inside of her for 2 to 3 days.
So that's essentially the third trimester digoxin procedure. Earlier, last time I talked about abortion, I talked about dilation and evacuation where the child's dismembered. That's more done in the second trimester. So it's grim. We should pray for everyone who's involved in this, for the children who are lost, for the mothers who will be carrying this with them for the rest of their lives, and for the doctors, that they will repent and have a change of heart, like Dr. Anthony Lovatno had, like Bernard Nathanson, who was abortion, did 60,000 abortions, aborted his own son. But then he changed his mind and he became pro-life. The other thing you'll hear a lot when you check the news is people will say, oh, well, these procedures, we need them for very, very rare fetal abnormalities where the child is just going to die anyways. There's an article on Slate that got a lot of traction. It's by Margaret Finn. It says, I had a late-term abortion. President Trump and pro-lifers have no right to call me a murderer. She says, in December 2014, I had an abortion at 29 weeks after my first baby was diagnosed with a brain abnormality called lysencephaly. And the early diagnosis, lysencephaly, is sometimes not diagnosed until after birth. Meant her case was severe and her prognosis was grim. Lysencephaly is a brain development disorder where the brain doesn't get curves. Normally, you look at a brain, it's very wrinkly. It's called a smooth brain. So the brain doesn't develop these folds, and so you have neurological impairment, and the child never really neurologically develops past 3 or 5 months. And usually, children with this prognosis died around the age of 2 because they couldn't control their seizures, they couldn't eat. But now we actually have medical technology to help children live until they're 10 years old, usually with this kind of procedure. So this is, I think, the important point here I want to bring up. This is what she says. I believe there are fates worse than death. My maternal grandmother was technically alive for 4 years after the aneurysm and a series of strokes that killed her, and I do not think she would have chosen that purgatorial coda. Just because we can prolong life with medical interventions doesn't mean we should. I believe torturing babies in the service of what my friend Grace Ombrey calls cosmic self-improvement projects is wrong. I believe torturing babies for any reason is wrong. Kate Carson, another friend whose words are so embedded in the way I think about baby loss and grief, I don't even know when I'm quoting her anymore, says she was presented with the option of giving her baby only one of two precious gifts, peace and life. Like her and like many parents faced with this impossible binary, I chose peace. So her article starts, no one has the right to call me a murderer. So murder is a term that refers usually to malice, having malice towards those that you kill. And I would almost agree in these cases, someone who's faced with a severe fetal abnormality, murder may not be the right term. Mercy killing or euthanasia would probably fit well here. That what is happening here is you have parents who believe their child is suffering and they want to end their child's suffering. So they do kill their child, or they cooperate with someone else to have their child killed to lessen their suffering, either now or suffering that may take place in the future. But we can still use terms like euthanasia, mercy killing, or homicide. Homicide just means the death of a human being. When people bring up these kinds of situations, it's important for you to ask, all right, and this is a strategy I call it's called trot out a toddler. What would you do if you had a two-year-old? Because in the article, Finn admits that lysencephaly sometimes is not diagnosed until after birth. What if your baby was born and you saw after birth they have lysencephaly? Would you inject them with morphine and kill them? If you would not kill a baby after birth, even if they had something like lysencephaly or another severe defect, then you shouldn't do the same to an unborn child. Now, as we noticed in our training last night, we talked about this in our pro-life training, some people will say, yeah, I would kill a one-year-old or a two-year-old or a six-month-old who had lysencephaly. They shouldn't suffer. And so when that happens, now you've got to take a broader debate and talk about the value of human life in general. And you can ask the person, okay, do you think parents should always be allowed to kill their child if they think it is in the child's best interest? And most people will try to draw the line somewhere that, you know, what about if my child's going to be in a wheelchair? Should I be able to kill him or her? What if they're going to maybe not die at 10, but they're going to die at age 20 or 30? Why should I give them a truncated life? That the way we treat the lives of human beings, the way we talk about them, we should look at all human beings as having equal value. So we can talk about it and say that we should give someone, it's not a choice between life and peace. It's a choice between, are we going to give them compassion? Are we going to, compassion, co passio, means to suffer alongside. Are we going to suffer alongside someone, or are we going to kill someone? Is that what we're going to do? So when this comes up, then I would point out to it. I'm bringing up here. This is a beautiful video I want to share with you to end our time together on this point, that when someone brings up the case of fetal anomalies, and don't get bogged down saying, well, sometimes doctors get fetal anomalies wrong. Sometimes they do. But in some cases, it's clear this child, if they have anencephaly or no brain, literally, they might only live a day or two after birth. You can say, look, what do you want to do with your child? Do you want to know that you showed them love and compassion and were there for them and provided them comfort as they naturally passed away? To have the chance at least to hold your child and to be able to hold them. And you know what? I have children. And who knows? I mean, my gosh, Thomas is always climbing on chairs. I'm always worried he's going to fall and crack his head open. I almost want to just get rid of the chairs in the house. I can't keep that kid on the ground. Things happen to our children. Sometimes we're blessed with children who outlive us and have long and healthy lives. But sometimes we're not. Sometimes our children, we outlive them. And sometimes our children have to bear enormous burdens. And as parents, we bear a burden of being compassionate along with them. But always having that sense of the dignity and value that they have, and knowing that if God gave us this child as a blessing and a gift, now is our time to return and let this child go and be with God now. So I agree with Finn. We shouldn't use unnecessary medical technology to keep someone alive when they are dying. But that doesn't mean that we should directly kill someone, whether it's injecting them with morphine after birth or digoxin before birth, that we should help those who are sick and suffering, not just kill them. And a great testament to that, I would strongly recommend, if you know people who are trying to wrap their heads around this and think that abortion is something that's acceptable for a child who has a genetic defect of some kind, especially a fatal one, a great video you can share is called 99 Balloons. It's the story of Elliot. He was born with Edwards syndrome, so he had an undeveloped lung, a heart with a hole in it, and he wasn't expected to live. So his parents threw a birthday party for him every single day he lived. He had a new birthday because they knew he would never make it to his first birthday, his one-year birthday. So he had 99 birthdays. He lived for 99 days. It's a beautiful video that you can have the logic that just, you know, if you wouldn't euthanize a two-year-old, you shouldn't euthanize an unborn child. And a lot of people can get that, but they still feel like, you know, if a child's just going to die anyways, where is the value in their life? And I think this video beautifully shows the value that even a child who's only with us for a few days can be a witness of to us. It's a beautiful thing. So I'll play a little bit of the end of it here for you to hear. If you want to search for it, it's called 99 Balloons. Not that old song from the 80s, but it's the video about Elliot, 99 Balloons.
An underdeveloped lung, a heart with a hole in it, and DNA that placed faulty information into each and every cell of your body could not stop God from revealing himself through a child who never uttered a word. Not a pulpit, not a slick presentation, not a best-selling book, but a six-pound boy with trisomy 18. God found great pleasure to take a lowly thing in the eyes of the world and show truth. At your funeral, we released 99 balloons, each balloon representing a day of your life. How beautiful it was to watch, how quickly they were gone. And so today, we celebrate. Elliot, you are well. And although we miss you more than we can express, we're only separated from you by our time left on Earth. See you soon, son, mom and dad.
So, this is at our training, people were emotional, you know, talking about this, and that's okay. It's okay to get emotional about this stuff. We should be. We can't let our emotions control us. The advice I give to those who are with us is to remember that the facts. Especially on abortion, but in general, the facts speak loudly, so we don't have to. We can go and we can make a case for life, answer these arguments, and show every single human life matters, every single human life should be treated with dignity and respect, and every single human life has the right to life, and it should be respected from conception until natural death. And so I hope you'll be willing to stand up and talk about that. So I'm glad you joined us. If you want a good resource on how to talk about abortion, my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, always a great one on that, and this podcast, and I hope our future episodes will bless you in that regard, and I hope you have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.